But we need young people to say, to have a revolution. We need people to understand and to accept. I mean, for instance, I tell the story, if you want to get through to people, there's no good getting politicians to say something to them because they won't believe it. Mm-hmm. But if their child goes to school and comes back and over a meal, they say, what did you learn today in school? And he says, I learned about nuclear power. And the parents will listen to their child more than they will listen to politicians.
Wade Allison, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Wade, you probably know I talked to Hugo Kruger. You've been on his podcast show, I think, at least a couple of times.
Yes, we've had a couple of meetings, and the first time I think I talked too much, but the second time was very positive indeed. I'm just trying to get you full screen. I'm not quite sure why.
Oh, I can do that. I can, yeah. I'll put you on speakers. Okay. I'm a huge advocate and fan of rational, logical, ethical nuclear technology, nuclear energy, and if we want to go on with human civilization, I think it's very important to educate, to enlighten, to clear up all these fallacies. there's a degree of stupidity, naiveness, or I don't know, ignorance that's been going on. Even when I think back about my educational system, school system, I mean, we haven't been really taught about the facts. So why don't we just start off about your background? I know you're emeritus.
Entirely my fault.
No problem. Okay, I was just speaking. Okay, no. Yeah. As I said, I'm a huge advocate of nuclear energy, nuclear technology, and I think it's really time to educate the public about the fallacies, about because there's always in every field there's a degree of stupidity or ignorance or non-informed, but it seems to me like on an educational structural level there seems to be like a intentional or I don't know, like deliberate, like suppression of facts or.
You're absolutely right.
Start off about your background, Wade. Why don't you just introduce yourself, please?
You're absolutely right. I was brought up in a similar educational system, which didn't tell me really what we all need to know. When I was at the age of 13, I was on holiday in France with my parents, and it was 1954. And we went to Geneva, and there was a big exhibition on there in the Palais des Nations, and it was Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace exhibition. And I was impressed, so I went home and I studied science. It was as simple as that, and then I. Went to Cambridge and did all sorts of sciences, in particular physics, and met still some of the great people of the day who long now dead. But I then went to Oxford and studied particle physics and went back to Geneva to CERN. And that was my background. And then about 25 years ago, Oxford added an extra year in its student curriculum, and we decided, what are we going to do? Well, let's teach them what extra you can do with physics and science. And so I started a course on applications of nuclear physics. And very quickly, I got into medical physics, which I didn't know about. I learned about it. I started doing cooperations, sending the students up to the hospital, and the girls doing physics learned that mathematical transforms can actually be useful for imaging people in bedroom slippers and so on. And it tied the ends of society together. I then gave a talk to the old members of my college one weekend and explaining to them the wonders of nuclear physics and what it could do for health and for the environment. And they didn't know anything. So I had to abandon that, the using mathematics to explain things. I have spent the last time since then writing. I've written two books with minimal mathematics in to explain with stories and understanding and actually to tie the ends of society together. And now, of course, with climate change, people are extremely worried about energy. And unfortunately, they've gone in exactly the wrong direction because the renewable business, that is what people society relied on before the Industrial Revolution. And they gave up their water wheels and turned to steam engines. And my goodness, the prosperity we have today depends on that transition. And to go back to water wheels and wind and sun, it's unreliable, it's weak, and you have to put in the numbers, just simple numbers, to see that it just won't work. And so that's what I do. I've been to around the world. I've just come back from a week in Korea at the invitation of Korean Nuclear Society, explaining, not so much talking to them about nuclear, but talking about getting the story across to the public and getting them not to worry about nuclear, in particular about the water from Fukushima, which they were very worried about. I said, and did calculations for them, I would drink it. It would be harmless.
Yeah. And there's been, it seems to me, it's been a systemic, communication of wrong, I was just going to call it wrong information, false information. And I would call it also nearly a tragedy that people don't understand that energy, we need energy. That's a principle, fundamental thing to understand. We need energy to, if we want to have a thriving human civilization. Otherwise we wouldn't have had this civilization as we have now. It's not that bad, but
that's right. But of course, there aren't many people who worry about it that deeply. But there are a lot of people who worry about their jobs and their mortgage and education for their children and so on. And they will always vote for the status quo, for no change. And no change means fossil fuels. And for fossil fuels, if you want fossil fuels, the best thing to do is vote for renewables, because renewables don't do the job and fossil fuels will go on being used. So there's a tremendous conservatism to go on with business as usual. There's a wonderful quote from an American journalist and writer from just before the war. He said, "It's very difficult to persuade somebody about something if their job, their salary depends on them not understanding it." Exactly. So the only people who actually have a completely free view on this are a few people who perhaps have independent means. But basically, old people like me, who are off the record, and the young people. And so it's the young people I try to get to. But of course, the school teachers don't understand either. So it's going to take 30, 40 years, or 40, 50 years to make this transition. But we've been here before. If you go back 600,000 years to the time when they first brought fire into the home, the resistance from the then Green Party must have been to say, God, this is incredibly dangerous to bring fire into the home. You must be absolutely mad. Of course, it's extremely important that we did that, that we taught our children, as we still do, to be very careful with fire because it spreads and so on. And nuclear does not spread like fire. It's much safer than fire.
Mm-hmm. Wait, you sent me an article, which I read now two or three times now by now. It's an excellent article. You make really great, wonderful points in it. Let me just share the screen and show it to my listeners. It's called Nuclear. It's one of your articles. Nuclear energy is abundant and available 24/7. It was published on June 13th, 2023, and you make some real good. Why don't we start off with, I would call it the psychological, emotional, mental aspects of this whole, around this whole topic.
Yeah.
What is it? I mean, this fear-mongering, is this like deliberate or is this really out of stupidity and ignorance or, I don't know, or is there some more systemic structural,
I think people prefer... People don't want to take on the whole problem. They look at their problem, their salary, their immediate neighborhood. And the problem is that coming to terms with nuclear involves an acceptance of what happens physically, then an acceptance of what happens biologically, because biology has been around for 3,000 million years, and it has learnt to protect us from the effects of radiation. But understanding that is something that biologists can do, but they don't understand anything about nuclear physics. And nuclear physicists don't understand anything about biology. And everybody else doesn't understand anything about either of them. So, and that brings the sociology part in. So these are simple questions, but they're on a very large picture. It frightens people to think that big. Maybe the kids will do that. They've got to do that.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I talked to Hugo Kruger last time on my show, he mentioned that this safety, so-called safety regulation, or I don't know what to call it, like standardized parameters, like how much radioactivity is dangerous or not, it's been like adopted since the 1950s. I mean, you elaborated in your article. Can you elaborate a little bit more about this?
Well, it's difficult for people to imagine now, but the 1950s, there was a man called Senator Joseph McCarthy, who frightened the death out of people in the United States. He had actors and playwrights and artists and so on being imprisoned because they were possible spies of the Soviet Union. The whole world was terrified and frightened of secrets. I just sort of remember that because it was in that sort of time that I went to Geneva in the mid-50s. And at that time, the authorities said, what are we going to do? We need nuclear power. We've got nuclear weapons and so on. What can we say to people? They said, well, if we can make regulations which say you are never going to be affected by this radiation because we're going to make it so low that it can never hurt you. And they actually put in an extra factor of nearly 1,000 in the safety.
Wow, times 1,000. That's right.
This is down by a factor of 1,000. Because in 1934, the year, in fact, that Marie Curie died, the people working with radioactivity and so on in the medical context, and there'd been some accidents. They knew a lot of the problems, and they came up with a simple number, which was what they considered to be safe. Now, in fact, that number, they got it right. In fact, in my books, but I didn't know, I actually didn't know that the number that they came up with, I came up with essentially the same number. So the present regulations are screwed down by nearly of a factor of 1,000. And of course, this makes everything terribly expensive. Like saying, you know, you've got, if you buy a car, and it's got to be 1,000 times too safe, and it's got to be bulletproof and gold plated and so on, it makes it incredibly expensive. Now, nobody knows how cheap nuclear could be if it didn't have all these regulations, because you don't need any very fancy minerals for nuclear power. The amount of uranium you need is tiny. And so there's no dependence on resources from China or the Congo or something that you can't get to. So all we need for nuclear is young people, young engineers who learn. They need the know-how. They need to learn about it, and the public need to accept it, and then we can move into a nuclear age.
Do you think, Wade, that we have structural systemic problems? I mean, these are the root causes. What is, in your opinion, from your point of view, like, what is necessary? What is necessary in order to, you know, to accelerate this development? You know, I mean,
there's got to be education. I mean, the politicians never look further than the next 5 years because for the votes that they get. So it's no good looking to them to change. We've got to start with the young people. We've got to. If that young girl from Scandinavia, I can't remember her name at just a moment, but if she knew the science, we could get somewhere. Unfortunately, she didn't and doesn't. But we need young people to say, to have a revolution. We need people to understand and to accept. I mean, for instance, I tell the story. If you want to get through to people, there's no good getting politicians to say something to them because they won't believe it. Mm-hmm. But if their child goes to school and comes back and over the meal, they say, "What did you learn today in school?" And he says, "I learned about nuclear power." And the parents will listen to their child more than they will listen to politicians or people who are trying to make money or bitcoins or whatever it is out of it. They will listen to what a child says.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is the route into society from the bottom up, not the top down.
Mm-hmm.
Because unfortunately, these regulations have been set in concrete by at the level of the United Nations. Of course, not all radiation is like that. The radiation we get from ultraviolet when we go out and lie on the beach for a holiday, that can have a very serious medical effect. That is radiation. It's right next to X-rays in the physics. But what happens? You learn about put some cream on, you get your doctor and your pharmacist tell the children what to do. Don't go out for too many days for too long in the sun. It's a family social matter. We don't have to apply to the United Nations for a sunbathing holiday.
Yeah.
And yet, there is far more skin cancer from ultraviolet radiation than there is from any nuclear.
Since you mentioned it, the sun, I mean, before, there's so many points, fabulous, wonderful points you just brought up about the sun. I mean, would it be accurate to say that the radiation or the, you know, the the dangers of being like taking sun baths, or the quality of the sun has deteriorated within the last decades. I mean,
no, that hasn't changed.
That hasn't changed at all.
No, I mean, The only thing that's changed is that some of us have been taking more holidays in the sun. In the old days, we couldn't afford it, so we didn't go to fancy places to get too much sun. So there's and we most of us died of other things before we got skin cancer. So now skin cancer, melanoma. I'm not a specialist in all the different varieties of skin cancer. It was a much more serious problem than it was before. But that's, as I say, because of social changes.
Oh, I see. Okay. So there's no connection because of the reduction of the magnetic shield of the Earth that's been...
No.
Nothing.
The ultraviolet comes from the sun. Mm-hmm. It's all part of the spectrum of radiation. And as I say, it's the younger brother of X-rays, and X-rays are the younger brother of gamma rays and so on. It's all one. I mean, that's a good argument to start with. People know how to deal with, and they just have to remember and practice and get the parents to tell the children, and the children learn, don't go out in the hot sun for a few days. But of course, you get used to it. Biology reacts.
Yeah. And, you know, as I also, you know, mentioned, or Hugo Kruger mentioned that, you know, as a certain specific, like, degree of radiation is, in a way, healthy, right?
Oh, yes.
Could you elaborate on that a little?
Yes, because, like everything else, biology reacts to the injury of the cells react. We know that if you get sunburn long before you get the cancer, the cells die off, the skin peels away, new grows back again. It's been used to coping with the effects of radiation since the beginning of time, and give it a week or 10 days and your skin will recover. Now, in fact, in the nuclear thing, a little bit of nuclear exercises. It's like going out in the sun a little bit every day. It's exercise. I like to tell the story of a race, the physicist says, right now, to do this marathon, I need all the energy that I can get. It's going to take a lot of energy, so I'm going to go to bed for a month before the race, and then get up just before the race, and I'll eat all the right things, and then I'll run the race. But the biologist says, no, I'll go out every day, I'll run a bit more and run a bit more and a bit more, and I will get used to it, and my biology will adapt to it. And on the day of the race, well, it wasn't long before the ambulances were out to go and pick up the physicist, because the biologist won the race. Mm-hmm. And I have found, from an academic point of view, the way that biology thinks and the way that physics thinks, which is my subject, are so different and so emphatically wrong, in the wrong connections, that it's interesting. But nobody learns. No, the courses of education specialize either on the one side or the other. And what we need is to look where they meet.
Yeah. I'm not, to be honest, I mean, I'm not a fan of the, because I went myself to a public school, very, you know, esteemed public school in Austria, but it's not only me, but so many other people, you know, you wake up after years or decades and it's like, what have we really learned? I mean, I had like really wonderful grades. I had even the A+, you know, in some of like six or seven super grades in, but at the end of the day, it's like, what have we really learned? We didn't learn to question anything, or the doctrine that we've been like, you know, shoved down our throat. Did you mention before Chernobyl? Because I was going to talk to you about like Chernobyl, because there was a documentary I saw. It's and there was an old, very old lady who lived nearby, you know, within the Chernobyl area, and she was totally fine, like with all the other animals, which you, by the way, mentioned also in your article.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit? Like, what kind of misinformation has been propagated?
Well, it's the overreaction. Some people did die at Chernobyl. Not many, but a few. And they were mainly the workers who went in there and poured concrete on the reactor from helicopters and so on. But that's not cancer. That dies very quickly. Because one of the interesting things that biology does is the way it reacts and protects itself is to immediately stop when the cells detect radiation. They stop replacing themselves in order not to copy mistakes, basically, and to use all of their resources for firefighting the damage that's been done. And if that cell cycle doesn't start up again eventually, then the biology fails, particularly in the gut, where the cell cycle works particularly fast. Yes, so the people in it at Chernobyl, and the similar people in Fukushima. Yeah. Yes. Now, I haven't been to Chernobyl, but I've been to Fukushima four times, and I've been into the evacuated region and talked at length with an evacuee and so on. And I tell you what happened. There was fear. People are frightened. And the psychological effects of being frightened were in fact, the only problems at Fukushima was fear. And the United Nations report from 2006 on Chernobyl said the same thing, that if you take somebody and tell them that you have been irradiated and it's so bad we're going to compensate you and we're going to give you an enormous amount of money. You can put it in Bitcoin if you like, but it doesn't matter. I'm going to give you a lot of money. And they said, well, I feel all right. What's the problem? But that can make people ill.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, just the thought of the psychological stress.
Yeah. I mean, it's like if, you know, if you see your friends one day and one of them says, what's the matter with you? You look awful today. And you say to yourself, do I? And then you start looking at yourself. Actually, there are cases of people dying as a result of being talked into being sufferers and feeling hopeless. In the old days, it was called cursing people, and it was how witch doctors and voodoo people worked. So the effects of psychology on our health are not to be ignored.
Yeah. Yeah. There was one point I want to bring up. I heard one theory from a nuclear engineer, actually. It's more sort of from a holistic point of view. He said that because, you know, our generation, let's just say, you know, or the kids that are growing up are much more exposed, you know, to whatever, maybe higher radiation, nuclear, would it be radiation, Wi-Fi, 5G, you know, all these things. Is it, would it be, do you think that it takes about like 15 to 20 years until these higher parameters are internalized into the DNA of the, you know, upcoming generation or the new generation that's going to be born? You know what I'm saying? Like, does it?
Can I stop you there? I stop you there?
Sure.
There's a break, which comes in the spectrum. In fact, it comes between sunlight and ultraviolet. It's right there in the dark. On the soft side, the warm side of sunlight, the radiation does not have enough damage to muck up molecules and affect DNA, and it doesn't matter how much. So that, for instance, if you have an MRI scan, involves quite intense radio frequency radiation, and the only safety requirement there is it shouldn't cook you.
Yeah.
Because basically you're going into a microwave oven where you don't turn the microwaves up too high. Now, that has got nothing to do with DNA. It's got nothing to do with radiation levels of the kind that affect from ultraviolet down through X-rays and gamma rays and nuclear. So no, Wi-Fi has no effect unless it heats you.
I see.
Because, of course you can cook, and that's not a good idea, but that's a huge amount of radiation energy, and it doesn't do anything.
Okay.
Because you're hot.
It would somehow translate into physical tolerance, more physical tolerance eventually.
Yeah, but it's a different tolerance altogether. It's a different... The word is ionizing. Radiation that is ionizing can destroy and change molecules and cut up them into bits and so on. Ultraviolet can do that, but Wi-Fi cannot. Okay. Period. Mm-hmm. Physics, that is not biology, not getting used to anything. It's just that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Let me just take not a really different tangent, still connected with that. What I'm always fascinated is that, I mean, we have had since when do we have nuclear propulsion technology? I mean, we're talking about like submarines or ships or whatever.
Yeah.
This sort of always baffled me. It's like, why haven't we achieved as a human civilization like to miniaturize it and maybe scale it up for other transportation vehicles? I mean,
there is one problem. You can't make it very miniature. Mm. You can make it much more miniature than the big nuclear reactors that we have. And that's coming. I mean, there's an outfit in Copenhagen, there's an outfit in London, who are working towards having nuclear-powered ships. And nuclear-powered ships are really going to be an extremely good way to go because you need quite a lot of power for a ship. So one of these small modular reactors of the kind that are being discussed now will match rather easily the energy requirements of a ship. And so efficient will it be that you can build a ship, you put the fuel in, and the fuel you put in will be enough to drive the ship for 20 years until the ship has to be broken. So you never have to refuel.
Yeah, it's a no-brainer, actually.
It is a no-brainer.
Yeah.
I've actually been working and advising quite closely with the London outfit, but the guys in Copenhagen are trying to work in the UK as well, and this is really going to come. And the Russians are already doing it because they don't have to conform to other people's thing because they just go around and they send these nuclear reactors on ships around the northern part of Russia there and provide them with electricity and, of course, fresh water. You can get fresh water from desalination and so on, mm-hmm. because
yeah, or the icebreakers.
I mean, we can talk about global warming and changes of that. And I have no idea, nor does anybody else, where global warming is going to end up. People talk about it as if it was going to plateau out in 2050.
No, I mean, this is a whole scientific fraud that's been going on with the whole CO2 hoax.
No, it's not a hoax.
What is it? In your opinion,
It is an extremely plausible, possible mechanism.
Man-made global warming?
Yes, but it might also not be. The point is that for the last 12,000 years, the climate has been extraordinarily stable. It wasn't before that, and it may not be in the future. And I would guess probably that the CO2 has started the ice to melt, etc., in the ice cap. This is just me guessing now. I don't know, can't prove this. Started the change, but the weather, the climate is so unstable that it's now knocked it off its equilibrium, and the change is going to come. And it may well be that it won't make any difference whether we succeed in stopping more CO2 or not. But we won't know that until it's too late. Yeah. So fossil fuels are not very safe, and their pollution is pretty awful in Delhi and Beijing and even in London in the 1950s and so on. It was dreadful.
I totally agree with you. I mean, when it comes to environmental pollution, that's a different aspect. I mean, you know, like global warming. First, it was called climate change, and it was global warming, you know. I mean, or global warming and climate change. So there is a...
Well, I think it looks to me, I'm just, you know, sort of looking out of the window. I mean, actually here in Oxford, I had 40 degrees last year.
Yeah.
So we did.
Yeah.
I know. Mm-hmm. So we really have to look at the evidence. But what's causing that, we don't know. How we would stop it, we don't know. But we certainly can't survive without energy.
And without CO2.
We can't survive without the energy. And if we're going to need extensive air conditioning everywhere, we're going to need a lot more energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think probably there's going to be a lot of death, and there's going to be a lot of migration, and from a climate change. But whether that's due to the CO2, we will never know. And we don't even need to know the answer to that question, really.
Well, fact is, I mean, we need energy. I mean, as long as we don't have structural transformational changes, especially, you know, with the evolution or the implementation, just simple implementation of nuclear technology, then, you know, the so-called fossil, I mean, this is a whole topic for itself, but you know, the oil and gas, this is what's actually, you know, caused the thriving of human civilization. But, you know, we talked about the military industrial complex previously. So this is what always, you know, just baffles my mind. It just, there's so much super advanced technologies within the military industrial complex, but it has never been translated into civilian use. And this is what I never understood.
No, but I think the military industrial complex and the safety industrial complex, I mean, this is all inertia built into people building empires and jobs and money and so on in a way that you can't stop them. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the military side of this is really any different from the civilian side of it. Mm-hmm. The safety industrial complex, oh my goodness. I mean, to attack these regulations is going to be a big, big problem.
Yeah, Yeah. Before we start recording, I told you, my podcast is focused on Bitcoin, and that's, I think this is the fundamental, let's just say the fundamental, the most important structural thing that needs to change is the monetary structure, the whole central banking, fiat money, criminal structures needs to really be made obsolete by adopting, a money that is not confiscatable, that is has absolute limited scarcity, and and there is no trust involved, right? So it's all math encryption.
You mentioned that word trust.
Okay.
That's everything in human society. It's trust in nuclear energy. It's trust in the financial system. I'm not quite sure that Bitcoin is any better than the curry shells that the banks hand out at the moment. Gold, it's useless stuff. You can't do very much with gold, except that it doesn't deteriorate. That's all. That's the only reason gold ever got in on the monetary business. I'm unconvinced that Bitcoin is more trustworthy because it's still people at the other end of the
transaction. But it's decentralized. Wait,
why is decentralized trust any better than centralized trust?
Because there's no trust.
I don't have great I don't have trust in the present mechanisms, I agree there's a problem. But you have not persuaded me. But that's not really what we're talking about, that Bitcoin actually solved that.
Right. But, do you agree we have, structural problems within the, caused by the fiat central banking system in collusion with governments?
Always has been. And as the thing has got bigger and tied together more and more with the idea that the more centralized you can make things, the safer they are. The same is true of safety regulations. If you can tie them together and put them in the hands of the United Nations, that makes it better. Well, as I discussed in sunbathing, that's not really where the trust is.
Right. To wrap this up, is there any few points that you want to communicate to the public, to my listeners? You talked in the beginning, it could take 30, 40 years. Is there something a process, something people can do or educate themselves about or take some action in order to
accelerate this process? Talk to the children. I think I may have you may have seen in the things that I've written, there's the question of nuclear waste. And if you go back into waste, our personal biological waste is very dangerous. We produce on the order of a kilogram a day. And it is the waste from our food. We learn to live with that, and we get the children learn to have to look after their own to an extent before we let them out into school, before we let them out into society. They've got to learn about that. Now, if we could have a fuel that was a million times more concentrated so that it produced a million times less waste, then we wouldn't have to worry about that waste, would we? Okay. Now, a million times less waste would mean that instead of having a kilogram per day, you had a kilogram in a lifetime with an extra factor of 100 to spare for all of the other energy that we use, all our heating, transport, everything, all our use of energy would be covered by 1 kilogram in a lifetime.
Mm-hmm. And nuclear waste is not a problem anymore, right? I mean, I talked to a couple of people now on my
show. It isn't, but it's a psychological difference.
Yeah, I see.
And of course, the media, nuclear waste is still a sort of inflammatory, controversial subject. They mm-hmm. say, no, it's not controversial. Nuclear waste is not a problem.
Yeah, and there's but very advanced technologies that can just reprocess that, right? I mean,
but there's not very much of it. And anyway, you can just bury it. It doesn't go into the atmosphere mm-hmm. or into the rivers. You can bury it. It's essentially solid. And in quite a short time, in 1,000 years, it'll be no more than dangerous than the minerals that you dig out of the ground.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fascinating.
An absurd amount of money is spent on the so-called coping with cleanup, decommissioning nuclear plants, all this. That is all that's got to stop. And you should know that the president of the Health Physics Society in the United States, well, it's an international thing with thousands of members, he has written with his seven predecessors as presidents of the Health Physics Society to the U.S. Congress, both sides of the thing, saying that this ridiculous amount of money being spent on cleanup of nuclear waste in the UK, it's Sellafield; in France, it's at The Hague; in the United States, it's at Hanford in Washington, and all this money is just powering jobs, essentially. It could go.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Yeah, this is a very deep rabbit hole. I think people need to educate themselves about starting with their kids and their children. Wade, you mentioned you published 2 books. Can you name them and maybe also where can people find you?
Well, Radiation and Reason is the first book. And that was published before Fukushima. Mm-hmm. And the second book is Nuclear is for Life. Publishers particularly are not very adventurous with things that are controversial. So I had to publish them myself. But they've just been, both of them are translated into Korean, also into Japanese and Chinese, and so on. And so, but the English editions, because I self-published them, the actual hard copy is sitting here, and I can send them to people. You can get them on Amazon, I sent some copies to Germany just the other day. Or there's an online, you can get an online version.
Great, yeah. And you publish also your articles on, I'm going to put that in the show notes, yeah, sone.org.uk, yeah, is that the website?
At Sone. Sone is Supporters of Nuclear Energy. And
yeah.
I'm secretary of the Supporters of Nuclear Energy. Mm-hmm. Nuclear energy, and yes, some of the things are on there, but now I have things all over the place. You can find them on things on LinkedIn and ResearchGate and so on. But
okay, right.
What's fortunate about having my name is that wade.allison@gmail.com gets to me. There's a Canadian ice skater with the same name, but I got the Gmail address before he did.
Okay. And you got your Twitter handle as Radiation Reason, so Wade Ellis.
That's right.
Radiation Reason. Yeah. Any final thoughts, or you want to conclude this great conversation?
Well, we need, as I say, unfortunately, some of the people I started work with on this a few years ago have dropped off the thing. I'm 82. This work keeps me alive. But other people will have to do it. Again, this is going to take a couple of generations to make this transition. But this is the Industrial Revolution Mark II. And I'm sure that as in Industrial Revolution Mark I, there will be a lot of tears and loss of life and so on in the transition, but we'll make it. And civilization will survive.
Yeah,
hopefully. If we put the work in.
Yeah, I learned a lot, Wade, from you, and definitely also my listeners and followers. So thank you so much again, Wade, for your time and for your knowledge, sharing your knowledge and wisdom. And hopefully, we can have another discussion in your very near future. All right.
A pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.